Let's read God's word, 1 Samuel chapter 1, beginning at the first verse. This is the word of the Lord. There was a certain man from Ramathaim, a Zuphite, from the hill country of Ephraim, whose name was Elkanah, son of Jeroham, the son of Elihu, the son of Tohu, the son of Zuph, an Ephraimite. He had two wives. One was called Hannah, and the other Penina. Penina had children, but Hannah had none. Year after year, this man went up from his town to worship and sacrifice to the Lord Almighty at Shiloh, where Hophni and Phinehas, the two sons of Eli, were priests of the Lord. Whenever the day came for Elkanah to sacrifice, he would give portions of meat to his wife Penina and to all her sons and daughters. But to Hannah, he gave a double portion because he loved her, and the Lord had closed her womb. And because the Lord had closed her womb, her rival kept provoking her in order to irritate her. And this went on year after year. Whenever Hannah went up to the house of the Lord, her rival provoked her till she wept and would not eat. Elkanah, her husband, would say to her, "Hannah, why are you weeping? Why don't you eat? Why are you downhearted? Don't I mean more to you than 10 sons? Once, when they had finished eating and drinking in Shiloh, Hannah stood up. Now Eli the priest was sitting on a chair by the doorpost of the Lord's temple. In bitterness of soul, Hannah wept much and prayed to the Lord. And she made a vow, saying, "O Lord Almighty, if you will only look upon your servant's misery and remember me, and not forget your servant, but give her a son, then I will give him to the Lord for all the days of his life, and no razor will ever be used on his head." As she kept on praying to the Lord, Eli observed her mouth. Hannah was praying in her heart, and her lips were moving, but her voice was not heard. Eli thought she was drunk and said to her, "How long will you keep on getting drunk? Get rid of your wine." "Not so, my Lord," Hannah replied. "I am a woman who is deeply troubled. I have not been drinking wine or beer. I was pouring out my soul to the Lord. Do not take your servant for a wicked woman. I have been praying here out of my great anguish and grief." Eli answered, "Go in peace, and may the God of Israel grant you what you have asked of him." She said, "May your servant find favor in your eyes." Then she went her way and ate something, and her face was no longer downcast. Early the next morning they arose and worshipped before the Lord, and then went back to their home at Ramah. Elkanah lay with Hannah his wife, and the Lord remembered her. So in the course of time Hannah conceived and gave birth to a son. She named him Samuel, saying, "Because I asked the Lord for him." And ending at verse 20, the Lord will bless to our hearts this reading of his truth. For Christ's sake we ask it. Amen. David, can you swap me over? Thanks. As I mentioned at the start of the service this morning, over the last few Sundays, we've been looking at a particular theme in our services. We looked 2 Sundays ago at "Help, I'm Depressed." And then last Sunday at "Help, I'm Busy." And next Sunday, we're looking at "Help, I'm Ambitious." And then in 2 Sundays' time at the evening service, we're looking at "Help, I'm Gay." But this morning, we're looking at this issue, "Help, We're Childless." There's a book in our house at home, and the book is called "The Ache for a Child." It's by an author called Deborah Bridewell. And it doesn't belong to me, it belongs to my wife. As most of you will know, Christine's a social worker, and she works in adoption services. In fact, she's one of 2 social workers in this congregation who work in that area. And it's one of a large number of books that she has on these kind of related topics. And she said to me once that on one occasion when she was talking to a person that she was working with, that the title of that book was exactly how she described her experience. This woman said that such was the desire in her heart to have a child that it was like a physical ache, like a pain that she lived with morning, noon, and night, 24/7. Between 20 and 25% of couples of reproductive age in the United Kingdom face the issue of childlessness at some stage in their relationship. And this experience, for most of them, is devastating, especially for the woman. It plunges couples into a monthly tyranny. It begins with hope, which is rapidly followed by disappointment and then despair, and then next month the cycle starts all over again. Dealing with it means intrusive and protracted medical investigations. And after all of this, sometimes one of the two, or occasionally both of them, will be found to have a problem. But actually, in 15 to 20% of cases, childlessness remains unexplained. There is no identifiable cause. Treatment, if it is possible, is often expensive and a roller coaster ride. And even if instead, having pursued medical treatment, a couple decide to try to go the adoption route, adoption itself is an intrusive and demanding process in a rather different way from the medical stuff. And this whole process, married life, having children, not having children, is shrouded in total mystery. I remember growing up as a boy, in a manse we had lots of minister friends, or at least my parents did, and we used to visit their houses and they used to visit ours. And I remember one particular couple to whom my dad was really close, and I remember going to their house on a number of occasions and meeting with them. And this particular minister and his wife, they had no children, and eventually they adopted children. And I think two, I'm struggling to remember, but I think they had two adopted children. And then when that minister and his wife were in their mid-40s, she became pregnant, and they had a child. And it is a completely unexplainable set of circumstances, because medically it was impossible, but it happened. And I'm sure many of us sitting in church this morning can testify to similarly puzzling and unexplainable realities that happen in family life. And that makes the problem of childlessness all the more difficult. Now, seeing this problem is so prevalent, as we've noted, in our society, up to a quarter of couples experience it at some time in their relationship. Seeing it so prevalent, it's hardly surprising that we find this problem in the scriptures, and that we find it often in very significant lives. And I want to look at one of those lives today to see what we can learn from the experience of Hannah. But before I do that, you may be sitting here asking yourself a question. The question might be, what right does he have to talk on this subject? He has four children. It's a perfectly valid and legitimate question. The only way in which I would respond to that is to say this, that when you look at other people's situations, their home and family life, their marriage and whatever, you should never make assumptions. You should never assume that somebody else's condition could not possibly be like your own, or they could never have gone through the experiences such as you have gone through. There is probably not a marriage, even though there are many children in it, that has not in the course of it faced problems and difficulties. So let's look at Hannah. I want to suggest that in Hannah's case, she had a problem in three areas, which are almost certainly present in these situations in lives in the 21st century in the UK as well. First of all, she had a problem with us. By us, I don't mean you and I mean Hannah and her husband. Okay? That was the us in her life. She had a problem, first of all, with us, because in the case of the subject we're looking at this morning, we have to remember that it's always an us and never just an I or me. It's always an us. And the two people in a marriage may see these things differently. There's a hint of that in the story in Samuel. We see that Elkanah loved his wife. It says in verse 5, to Hannah, he gave a double portion when he was up at the feast because he loved her. She was like really special to him, and he was caring and compassionate. He was a good husband. And also, he saw her deep distress. He was there when she prayed to God, and we read about her, and she says to Eli the priest, I have been praying here out of my great anguish and grief. This was not a situation that was hidden from him. But he struggled to understand it. For he said to her in verse 8, Hannah, why are you weeping? Why don't you eat? Why are you downhearted? Don't I mean more to you than 10 sons? He struggled with this. You know, it was a problem for him too. Of course he would have liked more children. But that hadn't happened, and he accepted and loved Hannah for who she was, which was probably quite unusual in his generation, where childbearing was such a significant and important thing. But he was like saying, it doesn't matter to me if we never have children. I don't love you any the less for that. Is it not enough that we have each other? Of course, in Hannah's case, it had medical reasons. This distress that she suffered. During the course of kind of doing a bit of reading for this, one of the books said that one of the biggest problems about childlessness from a woman's point of view is that of course the time of the month, every month when you discover that in fact you are not pregnant, is the time when, because of the nature of the hormones in your system, a woman is at her most vulnerable. She is at her lowest point. And issues like this, because they not only occur once, but they occur over and over again in the course of a relationship, issues like this can put an intolerable strain upon a marriage, and some marriages fracture as a result of them. Sometimes the problem is that one partner wants to talk about it, and the other doesn't. Because people deal with stuff in different ways. You know, there's some people, and they deal with stuff by talking about it endlessly. And there's other people, and they deal with it by shutting it away in a cupboard someplace at the back of their head and never looking at it again. And it seems to one or both sometimes that the resolution of this problem, the problem that they have as a couple, that they have been unable to have children, and if they could just resolve this one problem, it would fix all the other issues in their lives. But of course, it's not like that. I think one of the saddest funerals I ever did in my life, it was a funeral of a beautiful, married young woman in her late 20s, early 30s, I would guess. And she and her husband had a story around this situation in that they had been unable to have children, and they had gone through expensive, intrusive, painful, and difficult fertility treatment so that they could have a child. And they were successful. They had a little girl, and the little girl was the image of her mum. She was beautiful. And when that little girl was in the later years at primary school, her mum committed suicide and left the child and her husband behind. And you would have thought when they had invested so much of their energy and their commitment and their resources in having this child, that it would have been enough for them. But in her case, it wasn't. And it never is. It never is. Maybe this is something we need to learn in marriage. It's one of the things we need to learn. You know that solving the problems in marriage not necessarily make everything else right. You know, if we could solve some one particular thing. I was at a conference recently about leadership, and I was listening to somebody talking about the ministry, and they said this interesting thing that never really struck me before. They said, you know, you get ministers together, they moan a lot, okay? It's you know, because... Well, anyway, they do. And they usually moan about their congregations and mostly about their elders and things like that. You know, that's what they do. Probably when elders get together, they moan about ministers. I don't know. But anyway, that's what ministers do. And they get together and they complain a lot, you know, and they moan and get on. And they're sometimes not very good company to be with. And they moan about the problems of the ministry. And at this conference, this person, the speaker, said this. It really, really struck me strongly. He said, you know, the problems of the ministry are the ministry. That's what it's actually about. It's the problems. You know, that's what it is. And it's serving and working within the context of those problems. That's what ministry is. And the problems of marriage are marriage. It's not that you could really have a marriage if you could solve the problems. You don't have a marriage so long as you have the problems. The problems of marriage are the marriage. Getting to know one another, getting to love one another, getting to trust each other, getting to serve each other, you know, dealing with the stuff that comes down the pipe. That's what it means. Hannah's first problem was with us. It was between herself and her husband. And she had to get to a point where she realized that though there were problems, that solving those problems wasn't necessarily the solution to everything else. She had a problem with us. But then she also had a problem with others. She had a problem with others. People outside the marriage are rarely helpful in these situations. There is, for example, the well-meaning, loving parent who is always talking about when will the first grandchild come along. They mean it for the best, and it's part of their excitement and all the rest of it. But, of course, one of the difficulties is that's the one thing you would really love to give them, but you can't. And then there are the contemporaries. You know, there's that thing about when you get married, half of your friends get married within the next 2 or 3 years, you know, and they're all at the same stage at the one time. And the funny thing is that when you're thinking and planning about having children, guess what? So are they. And the difficulties that arise from that is that if it doesn't work out for you, then you find yourself in the middle of this, like year after year. There doesn't seem to be a month that passes, but that somebody else hasn't got a bump. And I found this book amongst Christine Stash last week, and it turned out it's a really good little book. It's not in print anymore, unfortunately, I don't think. It's called A Child at Any Cost by Mary Melia. And this is what she says at the beginning of the book. Listen to this. A few simple words possessed the power to throw me into a sudden downward spiral of depression and self-pity. Certain questions I struggled to avoid would flood into my mind yet again. I'd find myself praying, "Why, Lord? It seems so easy, too easy, for other people to have babies. Would I be such a failure as a mother that you couldn't trust me with a baby? Heavenly Father, why won't you answer my prayers and give me the child for which I long?" It had been simple words the kind people said almost every day that had this effect on me. "Have you heard Irene's news? She's expecting in April. She's always wanted a spring baby. Isn't it wonderful?" It was wonderful, and I knew it was. Yet words like these knifed my heart as I struggled to smile and reply, really meaning what I said. "Yes, that's lovely." I hoped the speaker would neither detect the anguish hidden behind my smile, nor notice my eyes brimming over with tears. If you are one of those who suffer from infertility, then you will know exactly what I'm writing about. You may be feeling happy and content, even congratulating yourself on how well you are coping with your personal disappointment, when a few casual words unexpectedly throw you off balance. Other people are a problem. Well-meaning parents, friends who are at the same stage as yourself, news that you receive every day. Sometimes, of course, it's worse than that because it's malicious. Hannah experienced that. We read in 1 Samuel, whenever the day came for Elkanah to sacrifice, he would give portions of the meat to his wife, Peninnah, and to her all her sons and daughters. You know, as if it wasn't bad enough that she didn't have any children. Her husband had another wife, and that wife had sons and daughters. That means she had at least four. She'd have to have two of each to be able to use the plural in each case. So she had at least four children. And Hannah was having to cope with this all the time, and that was bad enough. But we also read Hannah's rival kept provoking her in order to irritate her. It says it twice in the passage that we read. Sometimes people can be vindictive and malicious. I have a friend in the ministry. He and his wife have no children, and we were near neighbors for quite a while. In fact, he was convener of a vacancy when I came to a particular congregation, and we were quite close. And he worked in a particular congregation that had a massive manse. It was one of those kind of old-fashioned country manses, you know, and there was like 50 rooms in it or whatever. And a member of his congregational committee one Sunday who didn't really like him, okay, and if you didn't know that, you'll figure that out from what I'm just about to tell you that he said. But one Sunday he said to him, "I don't know what the purpose is of having that great big empty manse sitting down the street there." And sometimes people can be malicious and vindictive in the things that they say. And you know what? Church can be the most difficult place of all. To be in a marriage with no children. There's Children's Day. There's Mother's Day. There's Christmas. There's the ever-present youth work, and in this church maybe especially. You know, we have the GB display here on Friday night, and all these hundreds of girls in the front of the church, you know, and all the excitement and the anticipation and the enjoyment of it all. Church can be a really difficult place. And yet, you know, other people are necessary. Other people are necessary in life. And sometimes the relationship between those who don't have children and other people becomes like really, really significant. We have friends that have been friends all our lives since I was an assistant minister. They weren't married then, but they subsequently got married. They don't have any children. They have become honorary uncles and aunts to all our family. They're closer perhaps even than those who are their genuine uncles and aunts. And they have always been able to do that. They never forget birthdays. They're always there for special celebrations. They turn up on unusual times, send text messages, whatever. They keep in touch. And I know they do that not just for our kids, but for lots of other kids, of people who are friends of theirs. So we need other people. And when there are no children in a home, sometimes it provides an opportunity to do other things. Because those of us who are parents, my wife and I have been parenting now for over 30 years. You'd think we should be due to get a break, but And when you're parenting kids, okay, of whatever age, there's a fair degree of responsibility involved in it, and very often your timetable and your finances and everything else revolve around the needs of that family, and sometimes there isn't a lot of spare left over for other people. And there is, as Mary Amelia says in her book, so much need in the world. So much need. And sometimes it's hard to meet those needs and provide those needs when you're struggling to look after a family yourself. That maybe this is one area, especially, where those who do not have those immediate responsibilities can find in the will of God other responsibilities that are just as precious, just as special. Actually, two Sundays ago when we started this series, when the service finished, and invite people, as you know, to stay behind for prayer, there was a couple sitting just behind me, and I thought they wanted prayer, but actually they came to volunteer. So it was great in church life when people volunteer. And they came to say, look, John, two Sundays' time, we're going to be talking about childlessness. That's our experience. We've been down a long, hard, rough road, and we'd love to help other people. And if there was a chance that we could set up some sort of a support group that where we could kind of get together and talk through some of the issues or help other people in some way out of our experience, we always thought that God took us through it, not just for ourselves, but for other people. Here are people who want to sow into others' lives. And so if you look in the bulletin, you'll see that we're offering on Wednesday night to come along to I-56 to our house of prayer, where there'll be a small gathering of people. I know there's some people already committed to come, to see if we can set up some sort of a support group to help people so that through others you can find help rather than hurt. She had a problem with us, and she had a problem with others, and lastly, she had a problem with God. Hannah's big problem, actually, her biggest problem, was not with her husband, nor even with her sister, even with her husband's other wife, but her biggest problem was with God. And the passage is full of clues. For example, in verse 7 it says, her rival provoked her till she wept and would not eat. Well, you might say, well, what's the big deal about that? I mean, you know, if you're feeling out of sorts, generally speaking, you don't eat. And that's true, and there may be an element of this here. But remember that the eating in this case was not just an ordinary meal, okay? This was the meal at the sanctuary at Shiloh. This is when she and her family had come up to worship God. And the eating that meal was part of the worship of God. To turn away from the eating was to refuse to accept the good things the Lord had set before her. When she rose from the table and didn't eat, she wasn't just expressing her hurt. She was walking away from God. Not only so, but we read in verse 10 that it says, in bitterness of soul, Hannah wept much and prayed to the Lord. In bitterness of soul, she had become bitter, and that bitterness had filled her heart. And when she prays, look at what she said, O Lord Almighty, if you will only look upon your servant's misery and remember me and not forget your servant, but give her a son, she felt abandoned. That's what she lived with, and childlessness creates all sorts of emotions, anger and resentment and guilt and fear and bitterness and sense of abandonment, especially by God. And here at Shiloh on this occasion, the dam breaks. The dam breaks after a long silence. When she had not talked to God about this, or maybe when she had involved herself in formal prayers but never let go of the strings of her heart for fear of what would spill out, you know, if she really let go. But here, in these circumstances, in this moment, she gets grace to let go. And this is what she said about herself. I am a woman who is deeply troubled. I have not been drinking wine or beer. I was pouring out my soul to the Lord. I was pouring out my soul to the Lord. The dam finally breaks in her life, and all this stuff comes rushing out that had been there, suppressed in her heart for all these years. There was an element of guilt, perhaps, in it. You heard it in what I read from Mary Melia a moment or two ago, where she said, you know, am I such a bad person you can't trust me with a child? Is that what this is about? And the Bible seems to support this view. Because earlier in the reading we read, and the Lord had closed her womb. It says it twice. And is that what it means, basically? That what she was going through was a judgment. You know, that God was judging her in some way, and he was doing it by preventing her from having children. Of course it wasn't. Jesus makes this clear in John chapter 9, that it's not the way God works. You remember the man who was born blind, that he and the disciples meet, and they say, who sinned? You know, who's guilty? Was it this man or his parents that he was born blind? And Jesus said, neither this man nor his parents sinned, but this happened so that the work of God might be displayed in his life. See, he's come along this journey, Jesus said, so that he's going to cease. He hasn't seen anything from the day that he was born, but today he's going to see the work of God in his own life, and it's going to be amazing. And this woman had a problem with God. Perhaps she felt that God had judged her, but that wasn't the case. Sometimes religious people do not help in these circumstances. Eli, the priest, looks at her. He thinks she's drunk. How long will you keep on getting drunk? He says, get rid of your wine. But although sometimes religious people can be a hindrance and a difficulty, sometimes they can also be a help. Because we read that after Eli hears what is really going on in Hannah's heart, that she's crying out to God, that she's pleading with him, please don't abandon me, please don't leave me, come and answer my prayer. He says this, Eli answered, go in peace, and may the God of Israel grant you what you have asked of him. And something happened. Something happened. Because we read just in the next verse, then she went her way and ate something. You see the change? She went her way and ate something, and her face was no longer downcast. And then early the next morning, they arose and worshipped before the Lord, and then went back to their home. Something happened. In the prayer, or in Eli's response to the prayer, something changed in her life. And that something that changed surely had to hinge on two things. The first one was this, that in the prayer, Hannah gave up the child. She said, O Lord Almighty, if you will not forget your servant, but give her a son, then I will give him to the Lord for all the days of his life. She didn't ask for children, she asked for one child. And she said, if you give me that one child, I'll give him back to you for all the days of his life. He will never be mine. I will bear him, I will birth him, I will wean him, and he will be yours for all the rest of his days. What did she do? She gave back to God the one thing she most wanted in life. She said, if you give it to me, I'll not keep it for myself. I'll give it away. And she carried through on the promise. And there is that kind of heartbreaking story that goes through the next couple of chapters of 1 Samuel. You know that when the boy's old enough to be weaned, she takes him up to the sanctuary at Shiloh, and she leaves him with a priest. You know, and you kind of wonder, what would an old man know about raising a boy? You know, but she leaves him there. She trusts in God. And then every year she visits and she brings him new clothes each year when she comes. Can you imagine that? Can you begin to comprehend what that was like for Hannah? But that's what she did. She gave up the one thing in life she wanted more than anything else. In other words, she found purpose in conforming her life to the purposes of God. She gave him even her childlessness. Because not only was she childless, but she asked God for a child, and then she voluntarily made herself childless again. She found meaning in her own life by conforming that life to the purposes of God. You know, that just doesn't affect childlessness, folks. I've been discovering in my life that that's the single hardest thing that God calls you to do. To set aside your purposes, your desires and ambitions, and the things that mean most to you, so that you can give whatever it is you have to fit in with the purposes of God. I find sometimes it means you lose friends, it means you lose face, it means you get taken in directions you're not comfortable with, you're pulled way out of your comfort zone. And that's what Hannah did. She gave her childlessness to God. She said, let it conform to your purposes. Let it achieve something. And you know what? God accepted the offer. God accepted the offer. Read in 1 Samuel chapter 3, verse 19, that the Lord was with Samuel as he grew up, and he let none of his words fall to the ground. Goes on to the next few verses to say what an incredible prophet he became. His word went throughout Israel, and everybody acknowledged him as the servant of the Lord. God accepted the offer. You would think he wouldn't have, wouldn't you? You'd think he'd have said, no, it's okay, I don't need you to do that. Like, I can get 1,000 other children elsewhere. You want this child so much, I'll give the child to you, just keep the child for yourself. God didn't do that. He accepted the offer. He said, okay, fair enough, I'll take him. And I'm so glad he did. I'm so glad that God accepted that offer. Because later he would accept another offer. And that other offer would come from his one and only son, who was prepared to submit his life to the greater purposes of his father. And in receiving that offer, he accepted the sacrifice of his only son on Calvary for you and for me. That's the way he works. And Hannah's problem with God was solved. First of all, because she offered up to God the one thing she wanted more than anything else in the world. She said, if you give it to me, I'll give it back to you, and it will be yours forever, and I'll never ask for it back. And God accepted the offer. I don't know where you're at personally with this topic, but I do know that some of the principles that are involved in the issues of childlessness and the experience of Hannah in dealing with them apply to lots of other areas of our lives. And I know that when we get to that point, you know, that we deal with a problem with God, because that was the big issue for Hannah, okay? The other things were important, but this was the biggie. And when she dealt with that issue, everything changed, even before anything changed, if you know what I mean. Everything changed, even before she had a son, even before she gave him up, even before she went on to have 4 more children, as the passage later tells. Everything changed the instant she surrendered her life to the purposes of God. What about you? That's what we all need to do. Because there never will be blessing. And all the other things that we think, if we could just solve that one little problem, or if we could just get into this one particular area, everything would be changed. It won't change. Nothing changes. Until you bring your life into submission to the purposes of God. And then everything changes.